Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Millennials, the most productive workers ever. Okay, that's the opposite of the reputation millennials have in older media quite often. Of course, the kids these days lament is probably as old as kids themselves. So Malcolm Harris set out to learn how the kids these days turned into the millennial young adults who they are today, exploring the generation's relationship to education, work, behavior, and more. Millennials may have gotten a participation trophy to collect dust in the basement for every losing soccer season, but as he points out, they didn't decide to give those trophies to themselves. Bigger trends and economic changes have shaped a generation of jittery kids, he says, teetering on the edge between outstanding achievement and spectacular collapse. Here with me now to explain more is Malcolm Harris, freelance writer and an editor at The New Inquiry, and the author now of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Oh, and he's a millennial. Hi, Malcolm. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Probably should define loosely. I think people use millennials too loosely these days to refer to, like, even any teenager now who I think it doesn't apply to. So who are you referring to as millennials?
Well, in a strict sense, mostly I'm talking about people born between 1980 and 2000, Americans born between 1980 and 2000. But those edges aren't very strict. You have people who more or less, whose lives more or less comply with the trends I'm talking about, which is more important than what year you're born in.
So we hear about avocado toast and millennial pink, but not about the more urgent and serious issues facing the generation. Why did you write the book?
Well, I started thinking about the ideas around the 2008 housing collapse, the financial crisis, because I was in school, I was at the University of Maryland, and I was part of a student group engaged in a campaign against a tuition hike. And when the financial crisis happened, we tried to find some way to connect a tuition hike with the financial crisis. And it turns out that was a lot easier than we thought it was going to be. And that sort of led me down this path. And that's where the book emerged from.
Risk management is now our dominant child-rearing strategy, you say. You talk about the rise of the controlled play date versus just playing outside with neighbors and the general skyrocketing involvement level of parents in their children's lives in general. Why do you think parenting changed so much to look like this?
I think a big part of it is the rise of income inequality that we've seen and wealth inequality in this country. The stakes are actually higher than they used to be. In terms of how you prepare your child to achieve on the labor market. So if the difference between making it and not making it is bigger, we can understand parents, educators being more concerned in raising the stakes for children themselves.
What are the big risks, in your opinion, of this kind of helicopter parenting?
Well, we've seen a generational cohort that hasn't had the time and space to develop their own selves outside of being observed and being measured. And we see those consequences in terms of mental health, really observable long-term declines in well-being in terms of anxiety, depression, social trust in this cohort.
It's interesting because in the previous generation, I think there was concern for too little parenting. Parenting was getting too lax. Families were fraying, things like that. Was this a response to that, in your opinion, and the pendulum really swung the other way?
I don't know about that. I think it's all part of a single process. I mean, a lot of that rhetoric you're talking about was specifically racist, specifically anti-black, aimed at developing systems of control, target in particular Black and Latino students. I heard Eva Moskowitz is going to be on WNYC next, so we can hear all about that.
That's right, with Leonard Lopate after 12. Let's talk about how school has changed for millennials. You characterize students in school today as little worker bees, learning how to work and be ever more productive for their future working life. How is that different from the past?
We've seen, even under, especially under the Obama administration, a real focus on education as the building of human capital, the building of job skills. And it's important to remember that not everyone here, I'm not just talking about conservatives undermining public education. There's also liberals who have really pushed toward metrics for evaluation of education that measure students in terms of how successful they're going to be as workers in the future.
And all this focus on schooling has meant millennials are the most educated generation in American history, but yet they're worse off economically than their parents, grandparents, and even their great-grandparents. And I don't know if you chalk that up to the way millennials were raised, our attitudes today, or just sort of the trends in the global economy over the decades. How much of anything?
Well, it's a little bit of all of the above, but it's certainly not a coincidence. So if you look at the education rhetoric that we see today, the sort of everyone learned to code stuff, if everyone learns to code, then it's a lot cheaper for companies to go out and hire a coder, and wages for coders actually go down. And that's in a nutshell what we've seen across the economy in terms of the...
Whoops. I think we're having a problem with our guest line. So we will take a break and then continue with Malcolm Harris as we get his line back working. Author of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. And we'll also open up the phones. Millennials first priority. Does this sound like you? Mostly we've been talking about parenting and education of millennials and how it has shaped you emotionally, psychologically, economically. Are you relating to this? Call and tell your story. Call and ask Malcolm Harris a question. Millennials first priority. Parents of millennials, hold off for now. We want millennials yourselves to have the mic here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we'll take those calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Malcolm Harris, author of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. And we'll go to your phone calls in just a second at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But I just want to get one more concept out there, because you write a little bit about how the super competitive childhood environment that encourages every kid to shoot for the top, leading to what you call intensification. What is that exactly, and how does it manifest itself at work once the millennials are grown-ups? Why is it, as you call it, a bummer?
Labor intensification is something we're all pretty familiar with. It basically means you're working harder over the same amount of time. So you're being more productive in the same amount of time. And we see this with the introduction of technology into the workplace. Whenever you've got more human capital going, more skills, you're going to have labor intensification. And the costs of that intensification, instead of being borne and being shared by employers and employees, have been borne by employees alone. And so people have been working harder, producing more, and getting paid the same, if not less. And that is a bummer.
Danielle in East Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm just really happy that this segment is broadcasted, because I think it's really refreshing to hear somebody talk about the millennial generation, because I think major media has given the millennials all this flack about wanting to actually take control of our own lives and not be encumbered by the debts and the loans and things that people say that you need to have, when really we're just trying to make a better generation for those ourselves and those who are going to come after us.
Malcolm, want to talk to Danielle?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's absolutely right. And we can see why and how that's happened in the intergenerational balance of power in this country. If you look at, I think millennials are the largest voting demographic in this country now in terms of generation. And I think we have one representative in the Congress.
Really? Yeah. Only one?
Yeah, that was the last time I checked.
Yeah. Danielle, go ahead.
It just comes down to the fact that there are more of us. There are so many of us. And sure, a lot of people are lackadaisical, but then there are so many of us who are, you know, grinding every single day and doing exactly what we need to do to contribute to society and to do what we need to do for ourselves. And some people might think it's selfish, but I really just think that it's a different way of life. And I don't think that people who came before the generation of millennials should be giving us all this negative feedback about it.
Danielle, thank you so much. And this comes back to the paradox that we started with at the very beginning of the segment, that, you know, the reputation that millennials have, I guess mostly among older people, is that they're kind of lackadaisical in general. But everything we've been discussing in terms of the way they've been raised with this intense helicopter parenting and, you know, focus on being high achievers and everything has turned them into the most productive workers ever, maybe too much. So how do you square the perception and the reality?
Well, millennials don't own a lot of newspapers, Brian. We don't run a lot of radio shows. And so the perspective we're getting of ourselves, both us and the world are getting about us, comes from other people who don't necessarily have the same interests as us. So profits are up. Millennials are great for people who own businesses, who own shares of businesses, who are mostly not us. And they'd like things to keep going that way. And so we get this propaganda, this avocado toast nonsense that I try to totally just avoid in the book, even dignifying, because it's so separate from actual reality.
Mark and Nyack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks so much for taking the call. I just wanted to comment on the idea of the helicopter parenting. I do think that's a factor in why so many millennials are feeling, you know, why they're so productive and how we become so downtrodden. But I think another really big contributing factor is the fact that we grew up watching our parents raise families, own houses, all these typical markers of success. Because we graduated college with this insurmountable debt, a very tough job market, those markers of success are that much harder for us to reach. And it's kind of hard for, someone to square that away, work so hard and not get the things that our parents got so much more easily, or at least, you know, how we perceive that.
Malcolm?
And it's not just the cost of education, which has escalated totally out of proportion to almost anything else in the economy. It's also the cost of rent, which people know. It's harder to make a life for oneself now for this cohort than another cohort's past. And I don't think about that in terms of a betrayal of the American dream, which I think is a concept I was always skeptical of, never really believed in. And I think a lot of people in this generational cohort were also skeptical of. It's simply looking at what it takes to make a life now and figuring out that a lot of us aren't supposed to be able to make it.
Mark, anything else you want to add?
No, that's it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Joanna in Yorktown Heights. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how are you guys? I love this conversation.
Oh, good.
I definitely relate to this. I am in my 30s, so I'm what they call a senior millennial. So one thing that I've been hearing is the talk of work, and we definitely work extremely hard. And we do get exploited for it. I feel a sense of bitterness also within my generation that we have inherited a lot of economical issues, and we were told that this four-year education at a higher education institution would give us a good career, and we have not. A lot of my friends are still struggling, and it's very frustrating. And with the Republicans controlling everything now, I'm even more worried about my future, and I haven't been able to make any big life decisions because of all of the hard work and getting nothing for it is how I've been feeling.
Malcolm, talk to Joanna.
That bitterness makes total sense. It's an accurate reading of the world. There, on the back of the book, actually the back cover, there's a graph of what's called the rate of exploitation, which shows the rate of compensation versus the rate of productivity for workers. And I think this, more than anything else, defines the existence of our cohort. Because you look at it, and in the late 70s, early 80s, those two lines just split. And you see productivity keep increasing and compensation just flatten out. And so every year, that difference gets bigger. And that is embittering. That's humiliating. That's frustrating. That's any number of things. And we don't talk about that. That's not the center of our political conversations when it absolutely should be.
Joanna, thank you. And you're right about how the growth of mass incarceration, which of course has disproportionately affected black and brown people, has mirrored the growth and development of millennials. But you point out that most commentators don't make the connection. Why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just getting around to, in the past, you know, few years, talking about mass incarceration in the first place. And that's thanks to some very active scholars and activists themselves. So it's not surprising to me that we don't have a full picture of it. We also have a sort of racist idea of what a millennial is. We don't count black and brown experiences as typical of millennials. But when it comes to arrest rates, which have gone up for young people with the rise of mass incarceration, it's now estimated about a third of millennials are arrested before their 23rd birthday, by their 23rd birthday. That's a generational condition, and that's something we need to grapple with as typical of the millennial experience.
Especially for young millennials of color, broken windows policing doesn't allow them to socialize, horse around in public, do normal stuff that young people used to do, run around in a mall, drink beers in a park at night, etc., to the extent that white people do it. Otherwise, they'll get arrested. Right? I'm quoting from your book, but I think this is common knowledge at this point. State reinforcement, you call it, for the zero-risk childhood. Wow.
Absolutely. And, I mean, Tamir Rice, you know, he's a child who was shot for playing in public. And we need to understand that as something that has happened and something that children face, being scared for their lives for going outside and playing in public.
George in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian and Malcolm. Thanks for taking my call. I like to think of myself, I'm a millennial, first of all, I apologize. I'm a millennial, 25. And I like to think of myself as a conservative. I disagree with most conservatives when it comes to public education, though. I think that is one area where the government should really be concerned about the welfare of its citizens in that regard. We want to have a competitive economy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's one of the solutions. But Malcolm, you said something before about how conservatives, quote, ruined public education. As I know it, and I could be wrong, and you can correct me, we're spending more per student now on public education than ever before. I'm just curious if you could expand on why, despite that, conservatives have kind of ruined the public education in the country, as you put it.
Oh, I want to be clear. What I was saying earlier is that I'm not just talking about this liberal idea of conservatives ruining education. I think your position is conservative, actually, on education, but it happens to be one that liberals share. That's the Obama position, which is that the government needs to develop human capital for private industry. That we need to, and this is, you know, since the Higher Education Act in the 60s, this has long been a public idea, is that we need to produce human capital so that private industry can make profit. And I think that is a conservative idea, but it's also the Democratic Party's idea.
Tim in Hillsboro, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tim. Tim, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. So I'm a millennial, 24 years old, born in Pennsylvania, grew up in New Jersey, and I went to the public school systems in New Jersey. I found that as someone at the top of the chain, I was as ill-served as people throughout the chain of education, in that because everything was so compared and you were graded, when you were doing better than your peers, you were just as alienated. You were resented by them. And then now in college and seeing people in doctoral programs, they don't know how to work together. And it's all learning to the test, all inauthentic learning. And then the people who see the game see that we're kind of broken, move away from learning, really get a bad taste in their mouth.
Malcolm.
Absolutely. I mean, an arms race doesn't advantage any of the participants. Students aren't helped, even the students who succeed aren't helped by this extra competitive contest that turns their whole lives into a struggle for domination against their peers. The people who benefit are the people who own companies that these kids are then going to go work for, who have saved money on training costs. And that's what this is all about. And that's what so much of our generational experience is about. So no wonder people are sad, depressed, anxious, upset.
And to that, you're kind of nervous about the future. You outline at least 7 signs of what you call seriously wild SH expletive that we can look forward to seeing in our lifetimes, like human capital contracts, climate privilege, and a misogynistic backlash, and then a range of possible solutions. But then you outline some blueprints for change, and you say essentially the generation will have to make the choice to become fascist or revolutionaries. Do you think it's really that polarized?
I do, and it's not so much about polarization as this is the material situation. In order for wages to get back up to where productivity is right now, we'd have to see corporations, out of the goodness of their heart, double people's wages. And I don't think we're going to see that. I think a revolution that overturns this mode of society is much more likely than that. So I'm still an optimist, but I think it has to be a realistic kind of optimism.
Relating to that, here's a tweet from a listener that says, the election of Trump is a political cultural reaction to negative perceptions of rising millennial generation. In my opinion, writes listener Michelle. How much do you agree?
I think that's possible. I think there are probably some other explanations I would reach for first. Like white panic or white lash, as it's been called, is probably the easiest explanation. But sure, I think the Republican Party in particular, and maybe the Trump wing in the Republican Party most of all, has made an issue out of intergenerational tension.
And there we leave it with Malcolm Harris, freelance writer and an editor at The New Inquiry, and the author now of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. I think that was the making of a lot of fans. We've had overwhelmingly positive response to you. And let's keep talking. Come back on the show, okay?
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.